Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
This is the Truth to Power Show. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, and this is Radio Free Brooklyn. Today's guest is Rick Juro, who is a practicing alternative career counselor, a professor of religion at Vassar College, and author of Creating the Work You Love, In Search of the Sacred, Alchemy of Abundance, and more. His acclaimed seminars, based on years of research and practice with lineage holders in both Eastern and Western traditions, focus on interfacing inner experience with effective action in the world. Rick Juro is appointed in the Department of Religion and the Program in Asian Studies. He received a PhD from Columbia University in Indian Religion and Literature. His dissertation, Love, Language, and Silence, Readings of Separation in the Sanskrit Epic, Poetic, and Puranic Traditions, is a discussion of themes of loss in Indian literary and religious traditions. His research interests include religions of South Asia, Hindu traditions and Buddhist traditions, East-West studies, the Eastern Romance of Jack Kerouac, Indian languages and literatures, Indian epic and Puranic traditions, the poetics of religious experience and vocation. His book, Tales of the Dying, The Death Narrative of the Bhagavata Purana, was published by SUNY Press in 2003. So we'll be having a discussion about identity and the big questions in life, the elemental questions in life. And this conversation is going to start now. Thank you.
This is the Truth to Power Show. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm here in Poughkeepsie in a very conventional knowledge way. I'm here in a place called Poughkeepsie with a person I know to be named Rick Juro, who I'd like to allow to introduce himself. And you can say hello and say hi to the audience.
Hi, VK. Good hi. To see you.
Thank you. Thank you. So in the pre-conversations we had, I know we discussed kind of some preliminary questions, and what invoked in me a memory of in the 1992 vice presidential debate, Admiral Stockdale said, began the debate with, who am I and why am I here? Mm-hmm. And people seem to perceive that as strange or unusual, but I think in this context, I'm going to throw that question out, say, who are you and why are you here?
That's going to be that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, these kind of questions were called by Albert Schweitzer, German humanitarian philosopher, quote, the elemental questions.
Yeah.
I like it's, who am I, why am I here, and consequently, what should I do, what is my duty?
Exactly, yeah.
And, I would say the real answer to all these questions is very simple. I don't know.
Yeah, being open, I think.
Being open to the unknown. Socrates was open to the unknown. He said, I don't know anything. Even though the Delphic Oracle declared him to be the wisest man in Athens.
Yeah.
So it's not the I don't know out of ignorance or stick my head in the couch and watch TV for the rest of my life, which is what most of America is doing. But having the integrity to face the truth of the unknown instead of hiding behind ideology, history. You know, unfortunately, in our milieu, when you ask the question, who am I? Most people start thinking identity politics, gender, belief systems. And it's not that these things are not true, but they're provisionary. They're not ultimate. They're not consciousness.
Yeah, sure.
And we keep reducing. We live in a culture that keeps trying to reduce consciousness to identity, belief, and very, very minuscule senses of history.
Yeah.
You know, most of the educational systems, they teach you as if history began a couple of thousand years ago. And if you go to in France, those caves, the cave drawings are 35,000 years old.
Yeah.
They found cave drawings in Africa 90,000 years old.
Yeah.
So our sense of who we are is often bound up in our conditioning, in our beliefs, and our hopes and our fears. And these are all provisional. They're not ultimate.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, there are two points of view out there. One says, like the Confucian point of view, which it says human beings can never know the ultimate. Therefore, just, you know, deal with what you've got.
So what I would ask is, you know, when we ask about action and how to take action, or what action to take, coming from that stemming of acknowledging the not knowing, or acknowledging the limits of what we know, what the understanding I have in the conventional narrative is that, you know, people respond to circumstance. They respond to the demands of circumstance. And that, how does this ultimate, this glimpse into the ultimate ultimate knowledge inform that conventional response to demands of circumstance? Yeah.
I think the key word you brought up, BJ, is response. I would say most people, they don't respond, they react. Donald Trump says, it's time to react.
Yeah.
We react. And reaction is generally the first knee-jerk impulse of conditioning.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, truly responding is what opens to creativity, new dimensions of awareness. You made me think of a guy I heard of who was, he was working in a bookstore in Paris during the Nazi occupation, and he had been doing yoga for years, practicing Tibetan Buddhism. Nice practice, but nothing ever happened.
Mm.
And then he was arrested by the SS.
Yeah.
And they beat him silly. And as he was being beaten, his kundalini opened up and he saw everything.
Mm.
So you have to be careful about, you know, circumstances and how you respond to them.
Yeah.
We spend so much time trying to be in a comfortable box that we don't allow ourselves to be challenged by the very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that what we think, the conventional understanding that perceive is that people see their outside circumstances as out of their control, or that there's, you know, this happened, that happened to me, and they're reacting to the circumstances based on, from my understanding, what you're saying is that based on those embedded impulses, would you say, or what is the...
Yeah,
what is
it, you see it either out of their control or under someone else's control.
Mm.
So I blame the government.
Yeah.
Or I blame white people, or I blame whoever I want to blame.
Yeah.
As opposed to really, you know, responding from your depth. To me, Rosa Parks getting up from the back of the bus is that kind of response.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's so many examples in history. But respond is different than react.
And in the Rosa Parks example, the question is whether or not, you know, she was coming from a true place of seeing can you elaborate a little bit?
In my feeling, and I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I have another example.
Yeah.
I don't think she was coming from any calculation.
Mm.
I think that it just, she tuned into the moment.
Yeah.
Another very interesting example is the great singer Ella Fitzgerald was in a talent show at the Apollo Theater when she was a young girl, and she was billed as a dancer.
Mm.
And she got up, they said, Ella Fitzgerald will now dance, and she got up in front of everyone. All of a sudden, she said, no, I'm going to sing. Mm. Now, where does that ability come from, or how can one tap into that? To be in the right place at the right time, to say the right thing at the right time. That to me is the what I call alignment. That's what I'm looking for.
So one of the conversations I had in the show had to do with history and with the so-called historical events.
Right.
And the conversation I just had last night with Claire Van Winkle, who's another guest who will be airing later, is that she enunciated for me that there's no historic, we were discussing historical events versus personal histories, and the idea that, oh, these are historical events in the timeline of a collective, and that these things happen. And she was saying how the unveiling, or what is the unveiling that, my point is just that, or my what I'm trying to get at is that in every moment, there's a possibility to open up these powerful energies that can you see, or can I explain how, or can you expound on how, like, the opportunities are there in every moment, or
would you see that? Let's go back to history.
Yeah.
I like what Henry Ford said.
Uh-huh.
He said, history is bunk. I'd like to say history is bullshit.
Yeah.
But another way of putting it was, Stephen Dedalus, James Joyce's character, says, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken.
Yeah.
So the idea that there is an objective history is just a myth.
Yeah.
Whose history? When? You know, there are these people who live underground in New York City, the mole people. They have their own history. It goes back 60,000 years. Mm. You go to India, you know, where I go to regularly. Most people couldn't care less about Plato or George Washington. Mm. They have a different history.
Yeah.
So it's not that history is, a bad thing. It's to understand it's provisionary.
Yeah.
And can we be creative instead of dogmatic?
So I think there's definitely a story that is written in books that we read and that we encounter in a personal way, in a way that informs our narrative about ourselves, and tying it back to the who am I or what am I doing here kind of thing, that these elemental questions are informed by the thresholds that we believe that the collective has gone through, that collectively, that human race, if we want to, the humanity has reached certain thresholds where, you know, our perception of reality we project is radically different from the ones of the caveman or the ones of the story behind Revolutionary War America, that America today has a completely different perspective, let's say. And each person has their own thresholds and their own breakthroughs. And that what I wanted to clarify was basically that in our own personal trajectories and histories, how do we decide what to do when you reach a point of, okay. Yeah.
Well, that's why in the manifestation work that I do, that you've done with me, I encourage people to reconnect with their own history in the following way. To ask yourself, who came before you? Who's there who inspired you? Because that's a way of looking into your lineage and kind of figuring out what to do.
Yeah.
I read a week online Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize speech, which he didn't give, but he sent. And one of the things he says is he went to a Buddy Holly concert. He was really into Buddy Holly, sitting back in the front row. And at one moment, like, Buddy Holly just looks at him, catches his eye, and he feels like a transmission.
Yeah.
That's the way that, creating the history that's meaningful to you by asking who inspired you, who in the world, whether it's a year ago or 10,000 years ago, has done or articulated or vibrated something that really touches me.
Yeah.
You look at almost anybody who's ever accomplished who's broken through the hypnosis, it's because they found something or someone who spoke to them, and then they jump off of that.
Yeah, and a lot of people, I think, understand that they see something written or something someone says or a person's energy, and that kind of breaks through their own barriers and within their perceptions of themselves and their world, that light, if you will, is able to shine through, and they're able to perceive something that reveals or unveils a new energy, and that this lineage is a way to access the deeper energy, would you say? Or how does that operate?
What am I doing here? I'm connected with this stream of life, with this tradition. With the fighters for freedom, with the creative violinists, with the blues guitarists, with the compassionate therapist, you know, whoever really, whoever I tune in with. And that, it validates you, it empowers you, and it gives you a place to work from. Mm-hmm.
So that empowerment or that amplification of that energy and understanding that how do other people play into it? Like, I think there's one thing to kind of come to this realization and think, and then sometimes I think I find that when you talk about, or not, and anyone, I talk about these things, that people are putting that narrative of, oh, that's the born again, or that's the, and it's quick to, how do you break through
to
other people?
Very, that's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
Because very often, people who have great insights are immediately marginalized in the way you just described. Mm. Or we don't want to meet people, we want to put them in their own category.
Yeah. The classification of books, classification of information. As a librarian, I know, you know, we have a system of classification where the numbers help you navigate the knowledge within it, but it seems to me I'm questioning whether or not classification is helpful or not. I mean, in what way is it helpful? I don't know.
It's helpful in the way the scaffold is helpful.
Yeah.
It gets you there, but if you think that's the ground from the floor, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
The other way of looking at that is not worrying about what anyone else thinks, but connecting with the people who resonate with what I'm saying. And an example of someone who kind of practiced it and preached, at least to a certain extent, was Jack Kerouac, who his spontaneous prose, he said, look, if you write your gut, it's going to communicate. Because on some level, we've all experienced that.
Yeah.
You don't know who your audience is. You don't know who your people are until you really share your message.
Yeah. And the people who can hear, it seems like that. I know a couple of touchstones that I've heard, phrases that I've heard, that those who can hear will, those here will listen, or those who have ears will listen. Those
Bible
are
ears. Yeah. Who has ears, let
yeah.
him hear.
Let him hear, yeah.
Yeah, and it talks about how the word of God, you know, fell here, fell on the stone, and it fell on the wood, and then it fell on the fertile ground, some places in the root.
Yeah.
So, I see it karmically that there are certain beings who are meant to resonate with your message and who you are, and you express or live that authentically.
Yeah, I know that in the last, I revealed to you that I did a show on What is Love show, and in that we talked a little bit about universal compassion, but the gradations of between love and compassion. And one of the things we talked about was the idea of the Buddha seed or Buddha nature, and how all living beings, the assertion of Buddhism is that all living beings have that potential. But, and that potential, and then I'm connecting that with another teaching I received where if we choose to have the perception that everyone, all the living beings in the world have already attained enlightenment, I'm the last one to attain enlightenment, that might be helpful because that's a shift in perspective, that acknowledgement that we don't know what other people are going through, what's going on in their process. So, yeah.
On the other hand.
Yeah.
The question, what is love, cannot be answered.
Yeah.
The minute you answer the effect of human mind.
Limits. Yeah.
When people talk about enlightenment, they're back in the mind.
Yeah.
And the great insight, I would argue, is about every spiritual tradition, is that who we are is not the thinking mind.
Mm.
So again, the historical Buddha, or at least the Buddha story, just some guy who left home, sat under a tree, and said, I'm not moving until I get something.
Right? Yeah.
And then what people around him did and keep doing is they make a religion out of it. which is another way of not taking responsibility of your own awakening, you know, enjoying the flow. So we have lots of words, lots of organizations, lots of teachings, but, you know, we keep fighting each other, looting, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I like the Buddha's response when he was challenged by Mara, the Lord, that if you help me think you are, to get past me. And his answer was just tapping the earth three times.
Yeah.
It's not verbal, but it's like affirming, I'm here, I belong here, and I'm taking my stand of courage.
Yeah, I think that it seems to me that when we reach, when Buddha or anyone reaches a place where they're in abstractions, that it's easy to get lost and disconnected from the shared experience that we have in this moment in reality. That in my interpretation and my understanding of the hand touching mudra, where he touches the ground, is that he's connecting to a real place, a specific place in reality, that a specific moment in reality, that that forming that connection with that mental abstraction, almost, it seems like, you know?
Or beyond.
Yeah. Like, I was wondering to myself last night whether or not we see the manifestation of the physical universe, that we have, like, the core, that I don't know how deep I can get this analogy, but, you know, if we kind of leave the atmosphere and such, if we were to leave the atmosphere of what's shared among us, the shared place, the shared reality, then that's kind of like beyond the beyond you're talking about, or not physically, but in the mental space, that we've left that shared reality and that we have to come back to bring something to that discourse, to that narrative, that we have to bring back something to that in language, perhaps, that's the mission, if that's the thing.
I guess for some people.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely adding, they call it adding to the conversation or furthering the conversation. Yeah. But I want to get your perspective, because you brought up Jack Kerouac, for example. Sometimes I find it's difficult to follow his train of thought, that it's difficult to understand, and, you know, in the language, it's difficult to understand. He has a way of kind of, you were talking about the stream. So sometimes I think that we get to places where there are blocks or obstructions, and how are those obstructions removed, would you say? The methodology.
Perhaps the first place to go is to understand that I'm obstructed. That's a huge thing. I mean, if people are walking around like marionettes on a string, so yeah, I'm doing this, I'm doing that.
Yeah.
Gurdjieff used to say, you have to realize you're in a prison before you can get out of it. And then it's the quest of the individual. I would be careful with the idea of you go someplace else and then you bring it back to the shared conversation.
Yeah.
That's what people like Joseph Campbell really said. But another way to look at it is there is no place to go. There's no place else.
Yeah.
There's only here. Yeah. And you can go off on a tangent, which is your mind.
Yeah.
Or you can be present.
Mm.
And the challenge to me is to really be present.
Yeah.
At every moment, every breath, life, death, relationship. If somebody's saying something that bothers you or you don't understand, it's not trying to conceptualize what's he trying to say.
Yeah.
But just being with that energy, being with that, and you get what you need to get.
Yeah, I think that the concept that we're not responding to what is being said, but what we're hearing, or what we're looking at, to clarify or continue that, amplify that concept, that it feels like we already know what's going to be said, you know, or that we already have the preconceived notion of what's going to happen. Maybe that's the obstruction.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
or just our own schema,
yeah,
is the obstruction.
Oh, yeah.
So the question that people like Krishnamurti would ask is, how can you ever go beyond or ever see through your own schema? Can a computer override its own program? Like, this is the question of practice.
Yeah, yeah. So the practice of one's life is to, many people feel obligations. I have duties in my job, I have duties in my family, I have duties to my this, and this is what binds us. How can we shift that perspective to, rather than saying I'm obligated to, but rather, you know, that burden of, you know, people are frustrated with their positions, they're frustrated with their lot in life. And I understand that the theory is that we should transform these adverse conditions into the path. That's what I have been told and so I've been taught. But the transformation of the obligations we have into the journey, how would you say, or would you comment on that?
The question I always ask in that response,
yeah,
and it's not to be answered to simply, just to really feel it inside, is what am I learning?
Yeah.
What am I learning? Mm-hmm. And just to bear witness to what I'm learning. Mm-hmm. You know, Bernie Glassman, Young Peacemakers Society, for years he's developed this process where people go sit in meditation,
mm-hmm,
at Auschwitz or other concentration camps. And I was reading one of the chronicles of this. A woman was sitting there, and all of a sudden she just felt like how much suffering the guards must make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of like hating them, these are bad people, can you imagine like the amazing self-denial of maybe you have to turn on a, you know, a gas chamber? So it's not how to get out of it, but what am I learning from it? Also, just what is it a true obligation, or is it something I can create so I don't have to deal with the true connections?
Mm.
Is it a true obligation, or is it something I created to keep me away from the truth of emptiness?
Yeah. The truth of that, the perception that how we're seen in the world, I guess, is the way, understanding or unveiling the way that there is a way in which people perceive you, and that creates who you are based on that perception of you creates a circumstance that you're responding
if to. You buy into it.
Yeah.
What if you don't buy it? What if you decide that everybody you meet is a blessing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was something else that's not coming in right now.
So I think in the prison analogy, I'll just pick up on that thread for a moment. We see in people who have been in prison coming out, or maybe just a narrative, but they come out and they're still holding on to those routines of the prison. They're still holding on to maybe I'm just thinking of Shawshank Redemption, I don't know, but maybe that's all the information I'm getting from. But in the Shawshank Redemption, you know, he's still kind of internalized the experience of being in prison.
Until there's a moment.
Yeah.
The last time he's before the parole board.
Yeah.
And he just says, I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
And that's when they let him out.
Ah, yeah.
Because he's no longer buying into how they judge him. He knows who he is and where he's gone.
Mm.
And getting over that prison mentality is what William Blake called, you know, the mind-forged manacles idea. Wherever I go in London, it's like people's minds are in these chains.
Mm.
So how do you emancipate yourself from mental slavery?
Yeah.
How about more breathing, less thinking?
Mm.
More touching the earth, less worrying about what the earth is.
Yeah.
less abstraction and more direct contact with everything and everyone. Mm-hmm. I had a friend, a young man, as a young man went to India, and he met Ramesh Balsamar, a sage, a smart guy. And Ramesh said to him, "So what are you doing in India?" And he said, "I'm coming here to become a light." And Balsamar said, "No, you're not." He said, "You're here because you're not comfortable with everything in India." Think about it. Imagine being comfortable with everything and everyone. To me, that is freedom.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I have glimmers of it where I see the moments where I can remove judgment and I can experience the moment in through the sensory perceptions that I am able to connect to that without judgment, but. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's something you have to maintain, I guess. Yeah.
That might be why the Buddha and also shamanic traditions that I have read, they always tell you it's important to keep death in view.
Mm.
And for most people, when you talk about death, they think it's something that happened at the end of my life.
Mm.
But in fact, you're already dead. Because when you die, at the moment of death, you finally realize that you had no control at all.
Mm.
Well, you don't have any control now, you're just imagining that you do.
Mm.
So that surrender or trust in the process that what we're experiencing here allows you the fluidity to be a lot more comfortable, particularly with things that are not comfortable.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean you accept injustice, it doesn't mean you fate. No, that's not it. It means you're really connected to everything and everyone.
So to answer the question, what inspires me? I think, for me at least, the Buddhism, those teachings definitely inspire me, and reading specifically like Haruki Murakami, I really like, and I like the invocation of the dreamlike using the dream as a metaphor, using the dream or surreal, the access to the absurd almost, he gets into moments of absurdity where that disconnect between, or the discord, or like in music they have the harmony, though, so it's like a little bit of disruption in the harmony, and where there's a sound or that dissonance, where you begin to reveal that reality is plastic, that reality is flexible, and those moments where people call miracles, or people use those terms, where we can experience that if we listen for it.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. If we're looking, I mean, I think in any musical piece, that if we understand what is the harmony and what is the structure of it, rather, and what is referred to as a miracle. And there might be some low level, then you can separate out the frequencies, I would say, and tune in to that aspect of the song that people refer. It seems kind of abstract, and we just use it out of context, I think, like the idea of medical.
It's interesting. Yeah. There's a medicine in Orlando that says, quote, music is a miracle.
Yeah.
But, it's really, think about it. Why are we here? To sing and dance.
Yeah. And that ability to, I mean, we think about ourselves in terms of, on the first level, we think of ourselves in the very conventional level as a name, a label, as a name, a place and time. But then, the layers of who am I being, one layer of who am I is being on the body. That I'm this physical being, that the limits of me is this the edges of me is the end of my hand, the end of my foot, it seems to me that with the music you're able to dance, you're able to, at least in theory or in my understanding, is that you're able to then understand how to work that instrument, how to be able to get in touch with that instrument through listening, through dance, through these things that we're actually able to like use strumming guitar. And aren't any discipline like yoga or
And if you extended that metaphor, then it's all of it. Filing the papers, putting ink on paper, what a dance that is.
Yeah.
Preparing the food, it's all a dance.
Yeah.
We've just made it into this horrific task that we seem to want to punish ourselves for. What if Thoreau says that I see my neighbor doing penance in so many ways, my conquered neighbor. And notice how it works. The way the matrix works is by creating a suspense that is always resolved in the future. Who will win the election? Will there be a nuclear war? What will happen to the dollar? This is all complete fabrication. The answer is nobody knows. But it keeps you hopped up for the next drama. This is what I think it was DeVoe, the first French theorist, who called it the late capitalism, the culture of spectacle. Who's going to win the game? Who's going to win the election? And the problem with that is you're never here. You're always wondering about what's going to happen. You've never been here. You're living in this complete, like, hamster in a cage tomorrow business. And most people, like, if you push them, they know this, but there's so little social support to become conscious. Rather, there's a huge conspiracy, society, like a conspiracy to keep you unaware. The next thing, the next trend, the next, and so it takes a certain gumption to stand up in the back of the bus or to sit under the tree or to do your music. Not the music, it takes some kind of.
So I would say again to the question of what should we do in this world, the action taken, and versus the because in these instances where we perceive, this technology to be able to this approach or the scientific method or this ancient method of viewing the world in this way can sometimes lead people to still take actions that are harmful and hurtful.
Which method we're talking about?
I know it's like, the idea of perceiving the world as simply the emptiness idea, my understanding is that there's no external world as objective and inherent reality, and that it all is the mind creates it. So if we were to shift into that, there's removing the judgments that it's neither good nor bad, that history is all a bunk, and that this is the positioning of the I don't know, that this from this position of I don't know, it's easy to think that, well, it doesn't matter if I kill someone or
I would challenge the notion that everything is mind created.
Okay.
That idealist notion. Grass is real, trees are real, clouds are real. The question is, am I real in my relationship to them? And that, to me, is the crux of the matter. It's Martin Buber put it: all real living is meeting.
Yeah.
And when you're in abstraction, you're not meeting anyone. You're not tasting the food. You're not connecting to the earth. But rather, if we're living in connection with all of life, then the question of what is it becomes kind of less significant because you're really in that communion. And who knows, some may find out at one point that, like, the trees, the flowers, the rivers, they're already there. It's been waiting for the humans to get with the program.
Yeah.
We think we're, something else. So it's the idea of, I would say, relationship with everything and everyone, as opposed to abstraction and mind created.
Or that language.
Or it's not that the world is not real, it's that we've created fantasy worlds because we're not living in the world.
Oh, I see. So in other words, it's more like the world we're seeing is not what we think it is.
The problem is we're not seeing the world as it is. We're seeing our conditioning and our ideas about the world. If one ever saw the world, one would be absolutely shocked.
It would be
they call it in Sanskrit abhut, complete wonder. Oh my God, look at the sunrise. Oh my, so it's a question of being able to see things in your most fundamental relationality.
Yeah, and I think that the way the world manifests to most, to us, to me, to other people, to people, human beings, is through the way we see, the way we hear, all these five senses, and that without, to be able to see it without that hardware would not, you know, it would defy its own terms.
That's
right?
I would say without the software. One can make the argument that the fundamental crux of the conflict of Western civilization, maybe world civilization right now, is we have identified with the software. We are this program. But what if we're not, what if it's not, what if it was 2018, what if it's, that's just a program? There are cultures here that have no word for time. So that's the issue. Is it possible? And, and people ask, it's a big question in, metaphysical philosophy. Can you perceive reality without cognition, without mental, rational hallucination? And people come down on every level, but I would say instead of asking the question, you got to find out for yourself.
Yeah, because it seems that in the narratives that we've written in human history about this process, it's always a repeating recurrence of kind of going away and then coming back, but that to create a narrative where we're able to be plugged in to where we are now. We just hear so much stuff. It seems like we have to have the strength to be able to handle the perception, or where does the strength come in to be able to?
Or, I don't know if it's strength, integrity, but also a cultural matrix that supports imagination. A Muhammad, there was this 16-year-old boy on the caravan, and most people saw him as just a very attractive young man. Muhammad saw him as the Archangel Gabriel. He was crazy. William Blake said, "When I look at the sun, I see chariots and I hear holy hosannas. And you see a yellow disc in the sky." Who's crazy, so to speak? And the way I conceptualize that in my work is moving from the third to the fourth chakra. That the third chakra is the belief system, which is based on power. Foucault's been really clear about that. You look at any belief system, it's an attempt to hold on to power, even if it's a power, I don't know what's going on here, where you break through that web into love, and suddenly the other is not a threat, but is a synergistic connection. George Bach and Pablo Picasso going into each other's studios and not being threatened by the other person's work, but being inspired. It's like breaking through the need to say, "I know." Why do we don't? We don't know nothing. We know nothing. What we're holding on to, like titles and.
Yeah. Yeah. And the I think there's the response or the kind of impulse in many people and with knowing nothing is that that seems or can be perceived as a place of weakness, but actually I understand or experience that as a place of potential, you could say, yeah.
I forgot the gentleman's name, the German author of Zen and the Art of Archery.
Uh-huh.
But he's working with his master for months and months how to shoot an arrow.
Yeah.
And he knows this, and he has to forget everything. And when he finally forgets everything, there's that perfect release.
Mm-hmm.
And it hits the target effortlessly. So it appears weak, but it's a perfect, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's connected with the whole. So how can that be weak?
Yeah.
But this whole patriarchal culture of conquest is suspect, to say the least.
Yeah. So in that analogy that I've seen repeated about the Karate Kid, the wax on, wax off analogy, that his training begins when, you know, he perceives the, you know, in the movie or in these repeated motifs where the character comes in and asks for training, they say, you know, wash the car or something or wax the floors. And they perceive that as below or beneath the lofty ideas of what training should be. And how that, what you're illuminating here, what you're saying here is that, what I understand you to saying here is that in the discipline of committing those actions, conjoining that present of committing the action, and also linking it to, mentally linking it to perhaps, what your objective is, being able to see how that action can reveal your ultimate objective, is that the...
I don't think you can link it.
Oh.
I think it links itself to something. When you do it with integrity.
Mm-hmm.
If you really do it, sweeping the floor, waxing the car, if you really do it, then the Buddha nature comes through. And everything becomes art.
Mm-hmm.
And how beautiful is that? Especially because you don't have to judge it, everyone's doing their art. Mm-hmm. Isn't that like, that, to me, that's heaven.
Yeah, I think that I listened to a video of a bishop who was questioning the ideas of, the bishop on the video was basically questioning what we perceive as the ideas of Christianity, that, that there is heaven and hell, that, he was questioning that, so what some people perceive, let's say, as that, and the video was kind of presented in a way like, oh, you know, this is, and I just have, it's that the idea what I'm trying to get at is that we all go through the journey where we have a questioning process and we understand how these words have meaning connected to our own process, you know? So that kind of communicated what I meant to say.
My teacher, Hilda Charlton, when she was a young girl, one night, she sat up in her bed and she started yelling at Jesus.
Yeah.
She said, look, you may have done this, that, and this, the other thing 2,000 years ago, but what can you do for me now? I dare you. And she says, Jesus took her dare.
Yeah.
He became a real presence in her life.
Mm-hmm.
All these stories, to me, represent realities of consciousness that can be lived, and someone really lives through the Krishna story or the Jesus story. They really get it.
Mm.
They become born again.
Yeah.
And but they can't. That this is what's so frustrating to the mind. There's no miracle. You can't give it the 10 steps to becoming enlightened.
Yeah.
This is all like it's like the how do you say it? It's like the writing, the ingredients on the outside of the bottle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Instead of really tasting what's in the bottle,
yeah.
Keep reading the ingredients.
Exactly. I see what you're saying, yeah. And I think, would you say then that the objective, could you become enlightened by reading a cookbook?
Of course.
Yeah.
But, first, I go get and came enlightened watching a tulip fall. But here's the interesting. You can never be Camilla. Because there's no you. When you become enlightened, there's no you. So people in their mind, when will I become enlightened? Never. Enlightenment is. And yes, cookbook will do it. A rose petal will do it. Anything, if you're present with it, will do it.
Such a amazing light to shine, I think, and we want hopefully to penetrate that you know that narrative that we have that you have to find the right book, or you have to find the book that will, like, sometimes I go to the bookstore or library, anything that will connect with me, that in my perception of what's going to be the game changer, what's going to be the, you know, you go into it thinking, oh, just by reading this title or the narratives or the reviews I've read of it, I think that this book is going to be the one. But, you know, really speaking, you just go and pick up any book and be open to the possibility, you know? So that's a good note to close this interview on. If you have any last thoughts or final?
Yes, you know, a really liberated reading to pick up any book. I think for most of us, it's having the trust that the book that's been given to me is the book I need to really work on. You know, and the book of my own life, the book of my own circumstances, the book of my parents, the book of my culture. Like, can I work through that so deeply and so fully that, you know, Bertrand Russell said, I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. We've really worked it, and you've gotten the fruit. And that can be, but it's, the trust is so basic. Like, to trust what you've been given.
I think it's something that is something that is said often, that in my last conversation with about language, we talked about how familiar words can become unfamiliar. So familiar words can suddenly have the sense of, like, you're like the sensation that when I'm driving to places I go to every day, suddenly they become unfamiliar. Suddenly I'm like, where am I? What am I doing here? And sometimes there are places you've never been to. There's a familiarity. There's a sense of that I've been here all along.
Let's end this bit then with Zhuangzi's quote about words. Zhuangzi says, the fish trap exists because of the fish. When you have the fish, you forget the trap. Says, the rabbit trap exists because of the rabbit. When you get the rabbit, you can forget the trap. It says, words exist because of meaning. When you've got the meaning, you can forget the words. But then he says, where is somebody who has gone beyond words so I can have a word with them?
Excellent, excellent. Such a good way.
Where is someone who's gone beyond words so I can have a word?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This ends the Truth to Power show on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, VJR Nathan. Taking us out is MC Yogi's Rock On Hanuman. Please enjoy this song. Thank you.
as small as a cat or as tall as a tower. You devour lust, ignorance, envy, or greed. You succeed and never cower in the hour of need. You leapt to Lanka and reassured Sita, don't